Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Simon Rich is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. He's written for Saturday Night Live, Pixar, and The Simpsons, and is the creator of the TV shows Man Seeking Woman and Miracle Workers, which he based on his books. His latest story collection, Glory Days, sees Super Mario turning 40 and forced to take stock of his life and how messed up it's become. Goliath struggles to control the media narrative in the lead up to his death match against David, a small beloved child. And a long discarded participation trophy reminisces about the glorious field day in 1993 when he wound up in the arms of the jubilant asthmatic Simon Rich. Rich's other collections include Ant Farm, Spoiled Brats, Hits and Misses, which won the Thurber Prize for American Humor, and New Teeth. The new book is Glory Days, and it is a glory day when we get to talk to Simon Rich on The Book Show. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Obviously, I mentioned Saturday Night Live, but even of Simpsons and other writing gigs that you've had, even doing a sitcom where you're a showrunner, You're writing on deadline. The difference of that between what you're doing here in Glory Days, you don't have, I don't think, you have the deadline pressure.
Yeah, I also have the delete button, which is fantastic. I mean, you know, if you have a bad piece of writing, you can just literally erase it, which is something you can't do when you're performing live. So I think that, yeah, the delete button really is a writer's best friend, or at least my best friend.
So when it comes to the pressure of it, I mean, does a deadline help you at all?
No. I think deadlines only make things worse. I don't think there's any reason for them. Yeah, I'm not at all one of those people who feel like I need the crunch time pressure in order to perform. No, I want the more time I have, the better. I think my strongest short story collections are the ones that I spent the most time on, which is rational, you know, because you can throw out more bad stuff and revise and fine tune the most promising stuff. Yeah, I think deadlines should probably be abolished in general.
So how long did it take for this is I guess a circuitous way of me asking an obvious question, but so how long did this one take you to do?
Glory Days took me 3 years. I think it's probably the longest I've spent on a book. I think New Teeth, my last collection, took maybe 2 years. But what I do is I take like little pauses. So I'll write a bunch of stories and then I'll put them in a drawer for a month or 2 months and then look at them with fresh eyes. Because sometimes a story that I think is excellent will turn out to be less than excellent upon rereading it a month later. So I feel like these little pauses give me more like perspective and self-awareness about what's really working.
What is it about the type of things that you write about? I certainly wouldn't say that this book has a theme, but you are writing about the backgrounds of video game characters and even going back to David and Goliath. There is a looking back at things that are very familiar and looking at them in a new way.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, well, the cover image, I think, is really apt for this this collection. It's like a shattered, broken trophy. Thematically, the stories are all about characters reevaluating what it means to win. So you have characters who are kind of used to achieving traditional victory, who have to kind of gain some maturity and self-awareness and change their definition of what counts as victory. So, like, yeah, for the story Goliath, for example, that's a retelling of the David and Goliath story, where instead of tracking David, our hero is Goliath, who, when we meet him, has never lost a fight because he is an enormous giant whose go-to move is to rip people's spines out of their bodies with a single motion. And he's now faced with this new competitor, David, who in my story is sort of like equivalent to like what Justin Bieber when he first appeared on the international scene. He's this incredibly adorable, very young underdog, the first underdog, in fact, in our story. And the press, the ancient press, just absolutely loves David. And so Goliath, meanwhile, is in a sort of financial jam because he's gotten divorced. He's never been very good at managing his finances. He's not the brightest giant, and he needs to cover tuition for his daughter's private school. The public school didn't work for her because she is also a giant like her father, and she was bullied there. So now she's at this private school, but it's extremely expensive. And Goliath needs to raise some cash, but David is getting all of the endorsements, all of the sandal contracts, and so on. And so it's about Goliath kind of figuring out, how am I going to win this new battle, which is not a battle for glory, but a daughter simply to be a responsible father and keep my child in this healthy environment.
And at the early stages of this, David has game, right? I mean, David, you have David at a press conference.
Goliath watched in bafflement as the reporters all scribbled down the quote. It had not been about fighting, and yet, for some reason, they had found it newsworthy. "Let's get someone in the back," David said. "How about you, sexy?" An older man stood up blushing. "Thank you, David," he said, looking a bit flustered. "My question is about determination. Do you have it?" "Great question," David said. "Yes." The reporters burst into applause.
So he's got it down, right? For even
yeah.
for a youngin.
That's it. That's his superpower. He's not particularly good at fighting, and in fact has never fought in his life, but he knows how to play the crowd and play the press, and he's just constantly nailing the sound bites. Goliath, meanwhile, really can't speak more than a few monosyllabic replies to anything. He also, because he's so enormous, he needs to eat humongous meals every 30 minutes just to survive. So he's mainly just focused on when his next meal is going to happen
yeah.
during his press conference, which puts him at a real disadvantage.
A lot of meat.
A lot of
we're
meat,
told.
yeah. A
yeah.
lot of entire pigs. But he frantically need, you know, tries to get endorsements, but the problem, as his agent makes it clear, is that he's just not particularly sympathetic or rootable, especially compared to David, who is so beloved that over the course of the story, Goliath learns people are actually starting to name children after him. There's David is becoming a common name, which shocks Goliath.
But in the end, I think you make the audience feel sorry for Goliath, don't you?
That's the goal. Yeah, that's the goal. Is for the characters in the stories, they're kind of reevaluating, like I said, what it means to win. And I'm hoping through the process of reading the stories, the readers will potentially sympathize or maybe even identify with some of these protagonists. That's the hope anyway.
Simon Rich is our guest. The new book is Glory Days, a collection of stories. It is out from Little Brown. So the first coffee through the nose moment of reading your book was reading the story Mario. And this is Mario of video game fame, who is essentially telling us sort of an update of, well, the impact that this career has had on this man, this character's life.
It's like my whole life was a game. I'd wake up each morning shouting, "Wahoo! Yippee! And here we go!" That feels like a really long time ago. I was born in 1984, which means, if you do the math, I'm 40 years old. I wasn't really thinking about it much until last summer. Just another birthday, right? Then it's like the reality of the thing just hitting me. Like, mamma mia, I'm gonna be middle-aged. It's like one of those fireballs that move so slowly you forget it's even coming until it's right in your face.
So Mario, or Super Mario, as he was once known, when we meet him, he's like grappling with a full-on midlife crisis. You find out that he's lost all of his money, which is shocking because he collected entire screens worth of coins. You know, there are instances where in a single moment he swiped hundreds of coins, you know, and yet he's lost them all. And then you find out the reason why is because he made the mistake of letting Yoshi manage his money. So that money is just gone. Meanwhile, his relationship with the princess has never been more toxic. He actually accuses her of getting kidnapped by Koopas on purpose, which is problematic, but that's, you know, there does seem to be a wrinkle of truth behind it. Meanwhile, you know, he needs to rescue her, but his back is just completely destroyed from decades of sprinting around at full speed, smashing bricks with his face. He's effectively given himself arthritis. So when we meet him, he's at a real low point. And again, it's a character who is used to as one kind of victory, which is jumping, I guess, off of a castle and grabbing a flag and sliding downward. And by the end of the story, he's learned to have a little bit more perspective on what it really means to win and have a successful life.
You have him basically doing a going through a hospital checklist with Luigi.
Yes, yeah, so his relationship with Luigi is really fraught when the story begins. Luigi, we learn, has gotten sober, which is great because his addiction issues were killing him. But he's married to this guy, Kiwami, who is very nice and well-meaning, but Mario can't stand because he's constantly trying to steer Mario into like a more conventional career path. And it's really patronizing. You know, Kiwami actually forces Mario to make a resume in front of him. And Mario wants to put down, you know, his jumping skills and his rescuing skills. And Kiwami reminds him that really the only marketable skill he has is plumbing, and he needs to emphasize that experience. And so he has this really fraught relationship with Luigi and Kiwami. But by the end of the story, the victory he achieves is actually a reunion with his brother and closeness with his brother and his new partner. So yeah, it ends up being a very different ending than you know the ending of a video game. But ultimately for Mario, a lot more rewarding.
I mentioned this in the introduction, and you mentioned the we're talking about the cover of the book, but the story participation trophy. This is a letter to you.
Dear Simon, I'll never forget the day we met. You were dressed boldly in orthopedic Velcros, yellow sweatpants, and an oversized Far Side t-shirt. You completed your ensemble with a mesh green penny, which you debonairly or mistakenly wore as a necklace, your head thrust fetchingly through one of the armholes.
What brought you to take a look at the aforementioned participation trophy?
Well, for as a millennial, the participation trophy kind of looms large as it's sort of a true like totemic image for I think all American millennials. We all received these participation trophies during the kind of self-esteem boosting Barney the Dinosaur boon of the mid-90s. And I just thought it would be fun to write a story from the perspective of one of those participation trophies. And I wrote it kind of in the form of a love letter to the one that got away. And it's my participation trophy, which I was given in third grade. He now he or she or it now lives in a landfill. The participation trophy is kind of waxing romantically about our time together. Yeah, obviously it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous story. You have this piece of plastic, you know, talking about its love affair with me. But by the end of the story, not to give too much away, but you sort of realize, well, maybe there was something to those participation trophies. Maybe they weren't quite as disposable and worthless as my generation has made them out to be.
I mean, just the fact that you get to write from the point of view of a participation trophy or from the view of a horse. I mean, those are pretty wonderful, I would think, setups to get you started of things to say, oh, well, this will be fun.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing to do as a writer is try to tell a story that maybe we've heard a lot of times before, but from a new perspective. Like yeah, I do have a lot of horse protagonists. I find them really hard to resist. In one of my stories, I tell a story from the point of view of Paul Revere's horse. In the story, as the horse tells it, he and Paul Revere were friends, and they had this idea together to tell people that the British were coming. And they divvied up responsibilities 50-50. The horse was going to ride them there, of course, because he was a horse. And Paul Revere was going to do the yelling part. He was going to say the British are coming. And they would split the credit. But of course, that's not what happened. Paul Revere got all of the praise. The horse was forgotten, not even invited into the meeting house, was tied up to a post outside. And the story is basically told as a bitter celebrity tell-all memoir, with the horse just enumerating all of the ways in which fame has changed Paul Revere, or as the horse puts it, Paul Change. He's not the most articulate memoirist, but yeah, it's a story. That's like a story about insecurity and jealousy and bitterness and celebrity and fame, but hopefully told through like a different lens than we're used to.
Simon Rich is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new collection is Glory Days. There's a piece about you in the New York Times in which they tell your origin story. And it says, Rich typed this sentence: when I found out my girlfriend was dating Adolf Hitler, I couldn't believe it. What happened when you typed that?
So that was that's a story I wrote for a collection called The Last Girlfriend on Earth, which became the TV show Man Seeking Woman. And it was just like, it was the first time I had figured out a way to write a story that I thought was comedic and absurdist and surreal, but also emotional and honest. I was going through a breakup at the time, and that story is about a guy whose ex-girlfriend, who he's still in love with, starts dating like this older, richer guy, and he's really infuriated, especially when he finds out that the guy she's dating is Adolf Hitler, who is, they met in Buenos Aires. She was backpacking and they hit it off. And now he's 127 years old and he's in a motorized wheelchair and they're in Idaho. And he complains to his friends about what a horrible guy this Hitler guy is. And his friends are just like, you know, you just don't like him because he's dating Maggie, you know, give him a chance. Like, he's actually, you know, he's got some crazy stories, and you know, and also this is his party, and you know, he paid for all this food, so maybe like chill out a little bit. The story is called "Is It Just Me?" because he seems to be the only person who can't stand this new boyfriend. It's a story about, you know, how it can feel sometimes when the person you're in love with moves on. It can be an extremely isolating, lonely experience, especially when nobody can see it from your perspective. And that was a story where I realized, like, if you find the right metaphor, you can have a story that's really emotionally grounded and emotionally honest, but still go for the same kinds of laughs that you could go for in something like a non sequitur SNL sketch. And so once I wrote that story, I kind of decided that I was going to try my best to write in that idiom for the rest of my life. And that's what I've done these last five books of mine.
So you have done something that a lot of people have not been able to do, which is to have success with writing short stories. It is a form that, for some reason, which I've never quite understood, is not as popular as I think it should be, because people always tell you they don't have time to read a book. But I just think it's fascinating that this is something. Not only are you extremely good at, and then these are just hilarious, but it's what you like to do. It's something that's very enjoyable, and you keep doing it.
Thanks. Yeah, I love the short story form. I find that you can get away with conceits in a short story that would be off-putting were you to extend it to 300 or 400 pages. It also just comes from being a fan. Like a lot of my favorite writers growing up were short story writers. Writers like Richard Matheson or Shirley Jackson and Bradbury, Philip Dick, Stephen King, T.C. Boyle. Some of these writers also wrote novels, but I always preferred the short stories because I knew that there was going to be a killer hook by the end of page one, or an unusual point of view. And I just loved the economy of them and how big the swings were. I mean, that's the thing. Like when I think of like which pieces of fiction I've read that have taken the biggest swings, I always think of short stories. I think of The Lottery by Shirley Jackson.
Right.
I think of Born of Man and Woman, by Richard Matheson, which is still probably my favorite short story ever. 3 pages long, told entirely from the perspective of a monster child who lives in the attic. Extremely scary, witty, powerful, and you can read it in the amount of time it takes to drink a cup of coffee. And I was always astounded by the power of short stories to do that. I'm also influenced a lot by songwriters. When I think of somebody like Ray Davies of the Kinks or Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields, their ability to tell an entire story from a unique point of view in 3 minutes, I was always just dazzled by them. And I feel like I'm emulating my favorite songwriters too when I write these things.
Do you have to start with that hook, or is finding that hook often you have a vague idea and then finding the hook comes and then you're off to the races?
Yeah, totally. It's a lot of trial and error. It's like, okay, I think I vaguely have a sense of what the story ought to be, the premise, the subject, but then it's, well, what perspective is it written in? Is it first person? Is it third person? Who's telling the story? Where am I starting the story? And I do a lot of like trial and error, trying to come at the story from as many different angles as I can before picking a lane. It's pretty obvious to me when I found it.
You mentioned earlier Saturday Night Live. Once you're with that show, especially for as long as you were with it, are you always sort of attached to it in some way?
Yeah, definitely. I think it would be ridiculous for me to say that I'm not influenced by my time on that show. But I'm also, I would think, maybe equally influenced by my time at Pixar. Those are the two jobs I had in my 20s. I wrote for SNL and then I wrote for Pixar. I think I internalized a lot about writing from those jobs. Interestingly, the big lesson I learned from both of them is just like how to write economically. Pixar, it's film, so you think, okay, you have 90 minutes. But if you actually look at the scripts, you have very, very few words to work with. So much of the story is told visually or through music cues. So there's very little dialogue, like an actual like printout of the dialogue in a Pixar film. It's very thin. You would look at that pile of pages and think, there's no way that that could be an entire screenplay. It's not. It's longer than an SNL sketch, but not dramatically so. So I think like that was sort of the tyranny of like you need to maintain the audience's attention. You cannot digress. You need to be as swift and concise as possible. That was like drilled into me by both SNL and Pixar. But I think like Pixar is really where I kind of learned basic story mechanics of like how to make a character sympathetic and rootable and how to take the audience on a journey that's ultimately like emotionally cathartic or redemptive. Obviously, we weren't doing a whole lot of that at SNL. But I learned a ton at SNL too about joke writing, about dialogue. So as much as I'm indebted to like my favorite fiction writers for teaching me like the tricks that I use, I feel like I'm equally indebted to those two jobs, to SNL and Pixar and the lessons they taught me.
Well, I've heard you describe it as SNL, you were trying to make people laugh, and in Pixar, you were looking to make people cry.
Yeah, big time. Absolutely. And that was the bar. And then you focus group it. It's a similar process. You show the work in progress to a bunch of people in an audience and you see are they reaching for their tissues? And if they're not, then you go back to the drawing board just like you would at SNL if they're not laughing.
The new collection is Glory Days, and it's out from Little Brown. It is also an incredible audiobook that is read by John Mulaney. And if ever a material was perfectly matched to a voice, man, it just seems terrific.
Yeah, it's thrilling to hear him do it. He's a phenomenal performer and a wonderful collaborator. And I've gotten a few chances to write for him before, like whenever he hosts SNL, I go back and help write some sketches for him. But yeah, to be able to write essentially 4 hours for him was thrilling. Yeah, just the sweetest guy and hilarious, versatile performer. A lot more versatile than I think people know, because most people know him, of course, from his brilliant stand-up specials where he's always himself. And
Right.
so it's fun in an audiobook to hear him doing these strong characterizations, playing, an old-timey sea captain and a participation trophy and various animals and inanimate objects. It's a lot of fun.
That Goliath voice must have been a killer.
Oh, fantastic.
David is boy, Goliath is giant. We should not even be fighting.
Oh, man, it's just it's such a great monster voice. It's
That's
so
great.
Comedic and wonderful.
That's great.
And when you have something like that too, I'm thinking that there it also brings out which much of this is, you mentioned it earlier, about that millennial mindset too.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, we're basically the same age. So because of the 1990s, like I said, this there's the self-esteem era of children's programming and parenting, you know, I think that millennials were raised to be particularly not to generalize, but like particularly convinced of their own excellence and their own destiny. And I think we ended up being a generation that is underperforming our parents' generations in a lot of different ways. We came onto the national scene with, you know, in the late 2000s with big plans that have not always panned out. I think what we're like kind of most responsible for is the advent of social media, which I don't think is, it's not greatest generation material.
Maybe the jury's still out.
Who knows? Yeah. So maybe it'll all come around, but yeah. So it's like we set out, you know, to change the world, and in the end we invented and popularized Instagram. And so I think a lot of millennials feel like they are reevaluating their self narratives right now, or at least I do, and the characters in this collection Glory Days, they're very much grappling with that.
Simon Rich's new story collection is Glory Days. It is published by Little Brown. Simon Rich, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. That was a delight.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Again, Simon Rich's new book is Glory Days, published by Little Brown. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.